This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The coronavirus pandemic has brought the norms of everyday life to a halt, but that hasn't stopped our need to take care of each other. In fact, arguably, in some cases, it's probably even increased that need. So in this era of social distancing, how do we still show up for our friends, our neighbors, our communities? All this hour, we want to talk about that. We'll hear from local community organizers. We'll hear from religious leaders. We also want to hear from you about what's happening in your community. How have you and others been taking care of each other? Maybe somebody's been taking care of you and you want to recognize them. Call us with your stories. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. To start, let's check in with the nonprofit sector, which has been really hit by the economic impact of the virus. Joining us to do that is Erin McAleer, president of Project Bread. Welcome, Erin.
Deanna, thank you.
Also joining us is Mark Culleton, founder and CEO of College Bound Dorchester and Boston Uncornered. Welcome back, Mark.
Hey, thanks, Tiziana.
Great to have you both. And I want to ask you both to start by telling our listeners how, the importance of your work in the context of the coronavirus pandemic. Erin, I'll let you go first.
Sure. Project Bread is the statewide anti-hunger organization, and we have seen, we had a hunger crisis here in Massachusetts and in our country before COVID-19, but obviously it's escalated in recent weeks. So our organization is connecting individuals to food, both in the immediate term, but also food sources to ensure that they're able to access food in the days and weeks and months to come.
How about you, Mark?
Boston Uncornered is about engaging gang-involved young people to move from the corner to college, but really to transform their communities. And so we're reaching out to some of the most powerful but marginalized and vulnerable part of our population. And so our whole focus since this happened was to be there for those that are on the fringes and that aren't engaged with other sort of systems of support.
I feel like in this moment, some of the challenges we're all facing, we've seen coming, and some of them we did not see coming at all. So to the two of you, what have been the biggest challenges as a result of the crisis, and which one or ones did you not see coming?
Yeah, I mean, I think the traditional ways of accessing food, you know, school meals are one of the most critical anti-hunger programs in America. In Massachusetts, there's over 500,000 kids who receive free reduced price lunch. Obviously, it was over the course of one weekend where we had to transfer that model into an entirely new one. Fortunately, we had a playbook for it. There's a program called Summer Eats that we use in the summer when school is out. We had to implement it many months early. We had to find new partners who had never run this program before. And, you know, we had to put new processes into place. I mean, we have today school buses that are delivering school meals in Massachusetts communities. That's something that has never been done before.
I'm struck, Erin, by the creativity of that. And I think that's probably something that we'll hear more about as we learn how nonprofits are responding. Mark, what did you expect? What's been the biggest change and maybe something you didn't expect?
Well, I think in our community in Dorchester, Roxbury, Mattapan, immediately people were sort of thrown out of work and without basic needs. And so for us, the need to get as much cash and support and resources right away to the young people and the families that they serve was critically important. And then also to connect to the disconnected. And how do you do that in a virtual setting? So we went remote right away. But really had to get out there and get people connected to systems, find ways to communicate with them through their phones, through Snapchat, whatever that means is, to keep them connected, to keep them feeling okay, but really to get them resources for basic needs to be able to survive and to not feel alone.
Will they benefit from any of the money coming through the stimulus package, Mark?
Well, so the truth is that we're concerned that that won't happen for the most marginalized communities because lots of the young people we work with have never filed a tax return. Many are couch surfing without an address. We spent last week getting about 100 young people bank accounts for the first time. So We think that there's a whole swath of the population that won't be served. And so we feel like that's our job. And thankfully, we have some great longtime supporters and foundations and individuals that are stepping up to fill that gap.
Aaron, is there a surge in number of people who need food? So you gave an example of a program that needed to find a new way to distribute. But how are you faring in terms of just sheer volume of demand?
Yeah, so our food source hotline has seen a quadruple increase in call volume, and we're at week four now. So first week it was double, then it was triple. So now we're monitoring, you know, is this going to continue? Are we going to, you know, 4 weeks from now say we've got eight times the number of callers? So we've had to bring on three additional counselors to that team just to meet the demand for people looking to access food. And our counselors also, we're really focused as an organization on the federal nutrition programs. We think that they are the only programs that can meet the scale of this crisis. And by that, I mean school meals, SNAP, formerly food stamps, and WIC, that are federally paid for and can reach hundreds of thousands of individuals. So our hotline is also signing people up, doing SNAP applications. And so we've seen a quadruple increase across the board in calls, but also in application assistance.
As I listen to both of you, I feel sort of increasingly frantic as we're talking about this. And I guess the other thing that I'm wondering about is how are your workers and are they all working?
Yeah, so we felt like it was important to let people know that their jobs were secure. Our mentors are really frontline folks that need to be there and be there mentally and physically, even if it's from a social distance. So we ensured that we would support their jobs moving forward, the students that we stipend that too, and then really feel like it's critically important to have that connection in the mental health component and opportunities for people to take advantage of mental health supports in order to be there. And then those of us that could took significant pay reductions to ensure that we would be there for the most vulnerable, because that's really what I most worry about, both short-term and then long-term for our community.
Aaron, I think about, you do a big walk that raises a significant portion of your budget in May every year. I'm assuming you're not doing the walk, and I'm assuming that means there's money you got to make up.
Yeah, so we did cancel the walk in early March, and we were expecting to raise about $2 million from that event. We, our most dedicated walkers are still actually raising funds, and they're now raising funding for COVID-19. So, and our most dedicated supporters are the ones that usually raise the most amount of money. Now I don't think we're going to reach 2 million without having the physical event, but we do think that we'll still be able to at least close some of that gap. But yeah, I mean, I would echo what Mark said. My first instinct in supporting our employees was, especially because we had to cancel our major fundraising event, was to just assure them that their jobs were secure. People are, you know, professionally dealing with the COVID-19 crisis, but also personally. And I felt strongly that we can't be on the front lines responding to this crisis while our staff was worried about their position. So providing job security, but similarly providing overall support, you know, encouraging them to reach out if they need mental health services, has been really important to us, because we need our team to, you know, last for the days and weeks and unfortunately months to come. This crisis is certainly going to be with us for a long time.
I know you both know that I ran a large nonprofit. We did food pantries as was one of the things we did. And in late 2008, early 2009, I had somebody who worked for us who had retired from his first career. He was an older adult who'd been a child during the Great Depression, and he came home back to the office from one of our food pantries, white as a sheet, and he said to me, that wasn't a food pantry, that was a bread line. I remember that from my childhood. And I wonder, what are people not seeing that you're seeing in what the needs of this moment are creating? How can you bring that home to the people who are listening?
Well, I mean, I think we have to understand that those we serve and have the joy to work with are incredibly powerful and resilient. But their lives are incredibly vulnerable as well. I think about a student we serve who has been couch surfing since he got out of jail and doesn't have a permanent address. And so is like just staying at friends or staying. And so when we say shelter in place or stay in your home, what does that mean for somebody who doesn't have a home? Mm-hmm. And so usually just goes out and goes to school, or goes somewhere else, and now has no place to go. And so that's why we feel like the cash transfers directly to those most impacted is so important, because if he can give that family a couple hundred bucks to help them buy food and to help them keep him on the couch, that's good for him. But more importantly, it's good for us all when we're trying to do the things. But it's just a very different world than most people think of when they think do social distancing or stay in your home. If you don't have a home, if you don't have a bank account, if you don't have taxes filed, all of these resources may pass you by. And we need to be there for these young people, these members of our community, or we'll all suffer.
And Aaron, if someone's listening today and they're hungry and they need food support or they need other aid, where do they go? Where would you send them?
Yeah, I would say call Project Bread's food source hotline. The number is 1-800-645-8333. We can provide services in 160 languages and also for the hearing impaired. So please reach out and we will connect you to programs available in your community, but also connect you to the federal nutrition program.
I just want to repeat that number. Was that 800-645-8333?
That's correct.
Okay. Aaron McAleer, president of Project Bread, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Mark Culleton, founder and CEO of College Bound Dorchester and Boston Uncornered, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And I wish you both safety and well. Before we go to the break, we have some callers already, and I'd like to get at least one in. So let's go to Ellen in Brookline. Ellen, what's on your mind?
What's on my mind is that on, like, this is 3 days before my birthday, and I was shopping at the CVS in Coolidge Corner, and, you know, it took me so long just to find one item, and then after I just got barely two items, I had them in a handbasket, whatever, and I go to the cashier to pay for my items, and I, you know, because you know it took me so long to find the first item, the cashier whose name was James, you know, I used my debit card or whatever, and I paid for the items, and he put the items in one of the small CVS bags, what happened was my keys, to my apartment, you know, with the fob on them so I could get in the door, you know, like in CVS you have the scan tag and everything, so I took out that,
Ellen?
I was right outside the door, and all of a sudden, like, I see this hand, like, reach out, I took the keys, and I ran across the street to go home.
Good job, James, and good job, Ellen, for giving James that shout-out. I think this is the day to do that. I really appreciate your call. At a time that we need connection more than ever, we have been driven physically apart. Yet despite stay-at-home guidelines and recommendations to stay 6 feet away from one another, which we should all follow, people are still finding meaningful ways to help each other through this crisis and to create a sense of community. We're going to talk about what that looks like locally, and we want you to join us. What's happening in your community? What have you or your neighbors been doing to help out or to find community or connection? Are you in need? What's been the response from your community to support you? And if you want to give someone a shout out, this would be a great time to do it too. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. So with us for this conversation is Yasmeen Ammer. She's a producer and reporter for WBUR's Kind World podcast. Welcome, Yasmeen.
Hi, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
So did you hear the call from Ellen before the break, Yasmeen?
I did. I tuned into a little bit of it, yes.
So I just want to get your reaction to that kind of shout out right now, those little acts of kindness that people are doing for each other to make this world feel a little less scary.
I mean, if I can offer any comfort to you, I know people are isolated, people are alone, and there's just so much uncertainty going on. But if I can offer any glimmer of hope and comfort is that you live around some pretty incredible people. I mean, I do work, I've just seen neighbors step up for each other in so many little and profound ways. And it's not so surprising because I do work on a show about kindness, and times of crises are really the times that when people really step up. That's just what happens. And we're seeing that now more than ever.
So let us live a little vicariously through you, Yasmin, because right yes. now what you get to do in the middle of all of this is follow mm-hmm. kindness. How is that helping you or affecting you as we live through a global pandemic?
Well, it's been affecting me personally because it's just reminding me that people do care about each other. And I think our deep human nature. I mean, I know some of us tend to be cynical, especially as journalists. But again, like as somebody who works on a show about kindness, I don't really have to go out of my way to see these stories. Often they're really right there. And they're often right there when we're being tested during our worst moments. And so I keep going back to that again and again. And even during this pandemic, it's just humans, and it's humans being really good to each other. And I think for me, that provides a personal sense of comfort just when I'm stuck at home. And I really hope it does for you too.
It does, actually. It really does. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. I'm seeing that the lines are filling up really quickly. So let's take a call here. David's on the line from New Bedford. David, how are you?
Hi, Vivian. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. What are you going to tell us about?
Yes, thank you for having me. So so I work with Child and Family Services, which is one of the oldest nonprofit organizations in the southeastern Massachusetts region. I'm an intensive care coordinator, and we service, you know, all families, you know, dealing with crisis situations, and we are open for referrals. But what I started for my community is that I started an Instagram page called the Mindfulness Project. You know, also because I work in the behavioral health field, and just to bring in awareness and part of the social distancing, you know, is that we can still be connected through social media, and just, you know, things that I know from my organization and spreading, you know, just the importance of being mindful and finding ways to you know, keep positive. And
Does it help people with mindfulness practices? Is that what the Mindfulness Project does?
Yes, exactly. And it's just, you know, bringing awareness to using their senses, whether it's sight, vision, you know, to looking at the little things in life and appreciating them, and helping just spread that and taking those moments of, you know, that there's something positive in every day.
Great.
And something that's wonderful that I've been seeing in my daily walks is, you know, kids in the neighborhood, you know, they'll, I've seen pictures that they've drawn on the street, you know, saying spread kindness and other great messages. Yesterday, I came across, there was this poster that somebody created thanking the essential workers, you know, for what they're doing in the front lines, and just, you know, little things like that. I think it's...
That's great, David. I really appreciate it. It really matters to me, and I think to our communities, to hear these examples of how people are reaching out to each other. Yasmin, let me just give you a chance to react to what you heard from David.
I mean, this is stuff that I've been also seeing a lot. I mean, people have hopeful messages. I think people have different ways of practicing mindfulness. I've spoken to religious communities who feel like shocked. They're very surprised that their participation is actually going up during these times. I mean, it could be that it's easier to reach out like through a digital medium, but they feel like more people now are kind of tuning into their own feelings, whether it is positive or negative, but they are tuning into their feelings. And again, like with just people and neighbors reaching out, like through mutual aid groups, with people reaching out to each other, giving their neighbors a call, giving their friends a call. You know, I have seen that level of outreach
lot
more.
Just quickly, Yasmin, can you explain what a mutual aid group is?
Yeah. So a mutual aid group is nothing formal. There is no like head of global mutual aid or anything like that. These are very hyper local level groups. So these are neighbors just organizing to connect neighbors who need help with neighbors who can provide it. And so each community kind of builds their own. And it's something that's been around. This is nothing new. This is a philosophy. You know, this is a philosophy that's existed probably through like ever since time began. It's began, you know, like right when the U.S. A lot of new immigrant groups got help through mutual aid groups. Marginalized groups got help through mutual aid groups. And again, it's nothing formal. It's just groups of neighbors who felt like, I can organize this locally. And so we're seeing just a lot of people organizing that online, so, like through Google Sheets and stuff like that.
So Yasmin, we've got an organizer from a mutual aid group on the line. We've got Jesse Norris on the line. Jesse lives in Porter Square and is a core organizer with Mutual Aid for Medford and Somerville. Hey there, Jesse.
Hi there.
So I've never heard the term core organizer before. What does that mean?
It just means that we're a group of five that started this organization about 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago now when this pandemic began and started building out this network of different folks.
And what are you doing with the network?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different things that we're doing. As he's been described, there's main areas that we're working with, coordinating and helping people get groceries or medication delivery or meals or direct financial assistance. And so as folks need help, they can call our hotline, and that's 339-545-1315.
And let me just say to listeners, we'll have all these resources and numbers on our website. Sorry, Jesse, go ahead.
Awesome. So yeah, anyone can call our hotline throughout the day, and then we help guide them through different forms and asking, you know, what are the types of things that we could support you with? And then we have a network within the Medford and Somerville area of about 400 people that are, you know, responding to those requests and there to help their neighbors.
So you can't see your neighbors very much right now, Jesse, but in some way, has this made you feel more connected to your community?
I think that's exactly right. And recognizing, you know, we're all here in the same area and that we can be there for one another when we can't physically see one another.
And Yasmin, do you have any questions for Jesse before we let Jesse go?
I'm curious, what's been the most challenging part of organizing hyper locally?
Yeah, I would say the most challenging is that there's so many needs that folks have, and we're just trying to make sure that we can follow up with each person and make sure that they get the support that they need. So we've just really been building out our communications network and following up with everyone directly.
That's Jesse Norris, a core organizer with Mutual Aid for Medford and Somerville. I appreciate the time, Jesse. Good luck with your organizing.
Thank you.
So, Yasmin, let me just give you a chance to react to that story of, I mean, I couldn't believe it. I'm used to hearing people say my nonprofit is like 10 years old. They're
yes.
like 3 weeks old, this Mutual Aid Society.
They are absolutely organizing at just a hyper fast level. And I mean, I think it's just part of being hyper local and having to move fast in this pandemic. It's been weeks, right? But in Massachusetts, there are already at least 34 mutual aid groups. And there are probably actually more. It's just, again, because they're hyper-local, it's really hard to get centralized. But I would say, like, Massachusetts is doing, and when you just spoke to a mutual aid group organizer from Somerville and Medford, they've really led the charge here. They've been really organized, and they've really tried to reach out to people, even if they're not connected online. At the beginning, I know they passed out flyers, putting their numbers down, their emails, and being like, hey, if you need me, reach out. I know not everybody's online. They're also working to translate things for people who, like, English isn't their first language. So there's so many challenges, but they're moving really quickly. And that's been really admirable to see.
Let's go to the phones. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Rebecca on the line from Newton. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, I'm actually calling because I wanted to shout out a Facebook group that I joined called Newton Neighbors Helping Newton Neighbors. And I don't know if they would consider themselves formally a mutual aid group, but it's very much like that. They do everything from sort of soliciting donations for baby monitors that then can be dropped off in the ICU for COVID patients to somebody posted asking, who has horseradish for my Passover Seder tonight? And also another thing,
did they get the horseradish, Rebecca? Do you know? Did the person get the horseradish?
I think that they successfully got the horseradish.
Yes, excellent.
And I even asked, you know, do you know where I can get gluten-free bread? And it turns out a bakery down the street from me does it. So I was able to support them.
Good.
But they've been absolutely fantastic. And it looks like they only started up on March 10th.
That's awesome. Thanks for the call, Rebecca. I appreciate it. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To share your story of mutual support, mutual aid, showing up for your neighbors, how your community is showing up for you. Sandy is on the line from Bedford. Sandy, how are you?
Hey, I'm great.
Good. Tell us your story.
Hey, I wanted to give a big shout out to the Bedford 4-H Club, Farmers Club of Massachusetts. We are a farm stand and a general store that hosts a 4-H Club here. And at the same time of all this craziness, and we're trying to rearrange our business to do curbside and pulling orders. The farm is still very busy and collecting eggs and everything. My 4-H kids, they have been awesome. Our goats have been kidding. So we've been having lots of baby goats, and some of them need bottles. Some of them just need some extra attention. They've been sleeping in the barn, and they have been doing exactly what 4-H is all about, which is our head for clearer thinking, our hands for greater service, our health for better living, and just reaching out there and being part of our community, making our life run a lot better, and they're out there helping others as well. So
Sandy,
I'm just really, really proud of them.
If someone lives in your region and wants to get involved, how would they reach out to become part of 4-H in your region?
Well, you would want to contact the UMass 4-H Extension Office, and I believe that's in Waltham. And kids anywhere from ages 5 to 18 can join. And they live community service.
Yeah.
That is what they're doing. And we have young kids living community service. And I just think that's a great way of life.
I'm pretty sure my kids went to a camp at that program, a general store, and learned how to take care of the goats and animals. It's fabulous. Thanks for the call, Sandy. I appreciate it. So, Yasmeen, let's come back to this. So we've heard about mutual aid networks. We've heard about these groups of people who have either already been organized or are organizing. What are some other examples? I mean, you know, you're a professional who goes out and looks for these wonderful examples of how people are kind to each other. What are some other things you've seen?
So I think one thing to mention is there is some profound kindness being done by essential workers right now. I mean, I know on the one hand, they are doing their jobs, but when it takes so much self-sacrifice, I do feel like they do it with like a profound level of kindness for all of us in society. And so, I mean, particularly we've spoken to a lot of medical workers, and some have told me that they've even had to self-isolate just from their families, the people closest to them, in order to do their jobs and take care of us and patients. And so, something that I found really heartwarming are ways that people are stepping up to help these workers as well. I spoke to Sarah Keller. She's a first year med student at BU. And what she's doing is she organized a volunteer group of probably more than 300 people right now. And they're all medical professional students who really stepped up to help medical workers on the front lines.
This was a way to help the people that we really care about and to support them so that they can actually focus on providing patient care and doing all of the things that they're trained to do. And hopefully that they don't have to worry about taking care of their kids and getting groceries and all of that other stuff on top of dealing with a global crisis.
So Sarah's group is doing all of those things for medical professionals?
They're babysitting, they're pet sitting, they are, you know, running groceries, picking up like medical devices, just whatever is needed, because like you've got to feel some sympathy for all of these students. A lot of them are missing out on their clinical times. They're missing out on graduation. And so being kicked to the sidelines was really something that they were really bummed about, especially because they couldn't join in on the front lines at the hospital.
So
this is what they decided to do.
We've got another call, Yasmeen, and I think this person may be a medical worker. We've got T on the line from Boston.
Good afternoon. Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
I'm calling just to say that yes, I am a medical worker, and my older neighbor came up to me when I was getting my mail yesterday and asked me if I had some masks since he didn't have any, and he wants to protect himself and his other older family members if he has to, you know, make shopping runs or pharmacy runs. And so I was able to provide that for him, and it made me feel good to be able to help him and his family.
I want to thank you for doing that, T, and also for being on the medical front lines right now and being at work and taking care of our community as we are sick together. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
All right. We'll be thinking of you, T. Take care. Are there any needs, Yasmin, that you think aren't getting met that, you know, so hopefully we've got people listening who are feeling motivated and want to get involved. Are there needs that we need more people addressing?
Look, this is a pretty profound crisis. This is something that we're going to be reeling the consequences of this for a long time, and the needs are going to be great. So as wonderful as these groups are, I do think, you know, as people suffer extreme financial and health consequences, we are going to need like formal political groups to step up in addition to all these like wonderful community efforts. And I think right now, where I see, you know, some community efforts struggling is a lot of stuff is being organized online. And, you know, not everybody necessarily has online access. Again, some mutual aid groups have been really trying to reach out via paper, just good old phone calls. A lot of religious groups have been calling, you know, their congregants to just check in on elderly members. I know a lot of groups have been trying to translate their resources for people because again, like not everybody, you know, can. Yeah. So those have been challenges that I think a lot of people are trying to address. But I think the realest part of me also thinks that, you know, we are going to need a lot more like formal, again, political groups just really stepping up as this crisis worsens.
So, Yasmin, Kind World, the podcast, existed long before the pandemic. Do you think, given the arc of that experience and understanding of how we relate to each other, do you think that this time, the way people are showing compassion now, will change how we relate to one another when this crisis is over?
Again, on the one hand, like the way I want you to maybe feel better and think about the world is that we do have part of ourselves that is always willing to help. I think there's a really good part of, you know, human nature that we can tap into, and it happens time and time again, no matter what. So that's always sitting there. And I know when it's tested, it really does come through. But I think what's really unique about this pandemic, because it's again, so widespread, and it's lasted, you know, for a long time now, and we're not really sure how much longer it's going to last. But I think it is, I don't want to say forcing, but it is fomenting a lot of these connections that would have otherwise not happened. Again, like people are organizing with people they don't know at all. Like when I mentioned Sarah Keller, the med student, you know, she and like, you know, other people don't necessarily know each other. They just, you know, they connected and they started organizing and building this wonderful community of volunteers. And, you know, they're going to hopefully meet in person right after this whole thing is over. Same with people in you know, religious communities. You know, I spoke to a rabbi in Newton who gave me this wonderful example. And she said a lot of the young members of her group are reaching out to older members of the congregation, and they would have never otherwise spoken to each other.
That's
so
fantastic.
Here's what she had. Yeah.
Yeah. That we don't have time to go to the sound from that, Yasmin, but I think we can find, after the break, we're going to talk to a rabbi and a reverend who are talking about faith communities, especially during these holy days, and how they're supporting as well. We're about to end the segment. I don't have time to go to the last caller, but I did want to acknowledge our last caller, who was Coach Mike calling from Plymouth about the Boston Bulldogs Running Club, which is a club that helps people overcome addiction. They've got about 200 runners. I think Coach Mike wanted to give a shout out to the club, to the runners, and to the people who show up for those runners on a regular basis. I just want to say again to listeners, we're going to have an online list for a way to help in your community and a list of mutual aid groups around Massachusetts. Also, Yasmin, I think we're going to have a way for people to share their stories of kindness with Kind World at our website at radioboston.org. So I want to thank Yasmin Ammer. She's a producer and reporter for WBUR's Kind World podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on.
This year, there will be no gathering around the table with extended family for the Passover Seder and no congregating at church for Easter Sunday. In Massachusetts and across the world, people are stuck in their homes, distancing to prevent the spread of coronavirus. So what does that mean for these two religious holidays that rely so much on coming together? Tell us what you think. How are you celebrating Passover this year? How are you planning on observing Easter Sunday? What'll be different than years in the past? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Two folks have joined us to talk about this. The first is Rabbi Joel Seisenwein, Senior Rabbi of Temple Beth Elohim in Wellesley. Rabbi Seisenwein, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Also with us is Reverend Laura Everett, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Council of Churches. Reverend Everett, thanks for being with us.
Happy to join you.
So I'll start with you, Rabbi Seisenwein. Last night was the first night of Passover, which Jewish people all over the world celebrate with the traditional Passover meal, the Seder. Tell me about how last night was different for you than for other years.
Thank you. Before describing any sense of loss, I do want to begin with a word of gratitude to all who are on the front lines, the caregivers and the doctors and the nurses and all in essential services who are out there protecting us each and every day. At the same time, I do acknowledge that there was a sense of loss last night. This year was different than all other years, as Passover is typically a time when we welcome guests. We welcome our family into our home for a home observance, a Passover meal. And certainly last night was different as we were isolated and we needed each other. And so we really gathered over platforms like Zoom and the internet and the phone and any way we could connect. And I can say that Passover came just at the right time, because really it's about a holiday, about a people that is constrained, that is isolated, and comes out of the experience not bitter or distrustful, but if anything, even stronger than before, dedicated to helping the oppressed and caring for the abused and reaching out to the stranger. So I think that all in all, the feedback I've received was that it wasn't the same. And yet, in some ways, the messages of Passover resonated even more deeply this year.
Reverend Everett, these are important holidays in these faith traditions. What do we lose when we can't gather physically to either celebrate or observe them?
Well, I think it's okay to grieve what is lost. I'm happy to gather with friends in prayer online, but I know that I would much rather be breaking bread and singing together in person. The claim of Christianity is that God's love became embodied, became enfleshed. And so it's really hard for us to wrap our minds around this idea of the church not closed, but the church dispersed. You know, there's very little right now that resembles our prior Easters. And yet there's an honesty to this Holy Week. We're looking death and empire in the eye. And as another pastor friend of mine said, every other Holy Week is preparing us for this one. And for me, it's been really important to remember that the story of Easter, the story of Jesus's death on Good Friday, burial, and then resurrection, is a story that happens in a graveyard. This is how far God's love goes, even to the grave. And so I feel especially strongly this year, maybe stronger than any other year, that the message of Easter is for all those who are feeling entombed and isolated and scared, all those who are feeling traumatized like those first disciples, people who were afraid to leave their homes because the teacher they were following had just been executed, that God goes all the way with us. God goes all the way to the tomb. Holy Week rarely gets told like this, but it's a story of a traumatized people, too.
So I'm struck by some of the themes that I just heard from both of you, and I just wanted to give a second for you to react to each other, talk to each other a little bit.
Rabbi Joel, what are you thinking?
First of all, I think that the sense of renewal that comes through these holidays and hope are so important at a time when these faith communities are so accustomed to gaining strength from each other. And so it is good to share these common themes of renewal and spring at a time of increasing darkness.
And Reverend Everett?
I'm feeling really indebted to our Jewish kin, and feeling really tethered to the Jewish parts of the Easter story, too. My experience is that Judaism has a really robust tradition of home-based practices. Christians are used to expressing our faith by gathering in churches. And so, you know, today for Christians is Maundy Thursday, and in years past, I would have seen churches gather for our practice of celebrating the Last Supper. But this year, I'm having the Last Supper at home. I'll have it with my wife. We'll join our church online. But I'm watching Christianity become massively more home-based in our practice right now, and I really think we have a lot to learn from our Jewish kin because of that.
I'd like to grab a call here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Louise on the line from Brighton. Hello, Louise.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if my what I had to say applied exactly to this, as I'm someone who kind of stands between a few religions in terms of what they think. But this week I participated in a Passover Seder with friends, and I'll do some semblance of Easter dinner with family and friends through, you know, Zoom and whatnot. And I think it's really important that we're talking about all this in the face of what's going on with the virus, and remembering that however people connect across religions, it's important to do that. It's important to support each other. And I think if you look at both Judaism and Christianity, you see elements of that in the shared stories. You also see that people need to keep asking questions and keep persisting, if you will. And I think those are things that we all need to remember, whether we're thinking about our own families, the people we serve in our community, particularly if we're healthcare workers, regardless of whether we're on the front lines or if we're journalists or politicians.
Thank you for that, Louise. I appreciate the call. And I do want to add another caller voice here. So let's also hear from Liat in Arlington.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. Please go ahead.
Yeah, so, yeah, I wanted to share my experience. I know everyone has, you know, these challenging times. I have a one-year-old. I'm sure you can hear him in the background.
Hello.
Yeah, so we were able to connect. I actually have family on the island of Curacao. My parents are living there, and they're also on lockdown. And my husband's family lives here in the Waltham area. And his sister and brother's not far away. So we were able to connect, actually, my family with his. And it was just a really special experience, I guess, to do that online. And we were singing, you know, Achad Miodat or Achad Miodea. And we each assigned ourselves, which is a prominent song in the Seder, and we each assigned ourselves a number and kind of were able to coordinate a sing-along, which was quite remarkable. And I do think with some coordination and effort, it's a really nice, can be a really nice, albeit a little shorter of
yeah.
a Seder.
Thank you for that, Liat. And Rabbi Joel Seisenwein, do you have a lot of people from your temple who are doing Zoom Seder, basically? I don't mean to sound flippant at all, but...
You are not being flippant at all. It is quite a powerful platform. In fact, attendance at our worship has grown exponentially, fivefold, sixfold, and it continues to grow and grow. We're finding at a time of great isolation that the internet actually can bring us together in ways that we had never imagined, especially platforms where we're able to see each other. And so while we're a liturgical faith community that is dependent on a concise liturgy, we actually in our synagogue have decided to focus on people's faces as opposed to the actual words of the liturgy. Focus on seeing one another at this time of isolation. And we see conversations taking place non-verbally or through text or through email. It's quite extraordinary to see how the internet actually can be a great convener.
And Laura Everett, you are the head of the Mass Council of Churches. Is this a set of practices that you're seeing across the Commonwealth with churches? And good thing, bad thing, thing you'd like to have continue after the virus, hopefully the social distancing has passed?
I echo Rabbi Joel. I think, look, we've seen more change in the past
3 to 4 weeks than maybe in the past 3 to 4 years. Pastors have been enormously creative and innovative, and I'm so proud of so much change and welcome and adaptation and hospitality that's happened. There will things that will continue and that are quite good. And I think there are things that we miss and long to do in person, especially for Christians, celebrating the Last Supper, the Eucharist, communion. That's bread and wine, and we do that in community. And I know some people have been fasting from the practice of receiving communion, and people really longing to receive that too. So, you know, there's some things I think we'll keep on the other side of this. There are some things that it'll be okay to put down, but yeah, something fundamentally has changed for the Christian community as well.
We have just a couple minutes left, and I did want to ask each of you, your spiritual leaders in a difficult time and your spiritual beings in a difficult time, where are each of you drawing sustenance right now? What is particularly filling your cup or supporting you? Actually, Reverend Everett, let's have you go first.
Sure. You know, I've never pastored through a plague before, and there was no class on that in seminary. But the church has. The church has been through plagues before, and I'm really steadying myself by turning to older stories in the church. I've been reading again Bishop Richard Allen, who founded the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and Absalom Jones, were Black Christians who cared for white neighbors during the yellow fever in Philadelphia in 1793. I'm going back, I'm reading Angels in America about AIDS in New York. I've been following the travails of Saint Rocco, a Roman Catholic saint from Italy in the 1300s, who stayed alive because he was fed by a dog and a wealthy neighbor. And so what's helping me in these past disruptions is learning from the past faith of my ancestors, and blessedly that includes the story of Exodus, the story of the Israelites and the plague.
I'm sorry to stop you there, but I want to make sure we get a chance to hear from Rabbi Joel Seisenwine too before we have to go. Go ahead, Rabbi Joel.
Thanks. I'll just say briefly, Passover teaches us that people can overcome difficulties and even grow stronger when they remain united and dedicated to a common purpose. And that's where I'm gaining my sustenance. I am seeing people reach out in ways like never before. We asked for volunteers to deliver groceries to those who are isolated or can't go out. And we saw more volunteers step forward than I have ever seen in the last 25 years of my rabbinate. People want to do good.
That's the perfect place to end our show today. Rabbi Joel Seisenwine,
Amen.
Senior Rabbi of Temple Beth Elohim in Wellesley, and Laura Everett, Reverend Laura Everett, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Council of Churches. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you. If I can just say happy Easter and happy Passover.
Thank you.
Blessings upon you.